You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, April 15th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the three-time award-winning The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City, I'm Matt and Mike.
Tuesday.
On today's program, Eli Clifton, investigative fellow at the Nation Institute, talking about how pharma played a double game during Obamacare, and also the GOP mega donor who supports marriage equality and gets fawning articles about how moderate he is, even though his other main agenda is bombing Iran.
We also have another guest today, Matt Ford, fellow at the Atlantic. And we're going to be discussing a bit more about this Bundy Ranch issue that seems to be the talk of everybody. We're going to be focusing on what does Clive and Bundy's wonderful, beloved state of Nevada, have to say about all this.
Matt will be working on the pronunciation of yes. Nevada throughout most of the program. I will also be working on my pronunciation of woman or woman. Apparently, it's disconcerting to some people. I apologize. I cannot completely expunge my distant Long Island accent, folks. It is there. Well, I'm not ashamed or proud of it. It just is. Also on the show, Scotty B. New news from him. Navigating the wilds of New Hampshire and being rad at the same time in a certain
totally
sense.
Totally not from Massachusetts.
In a certain sense I was, but like not. Also, new climate report saying that actually it won't cost us as much as we think to avert disaster. New developments in Ukraine. And I'm going to summarize all of these stupid ideas in foreign policy that are floating around Ukraine. I'm going to do a big master list.
Also, what happens when a church erects a homeless Jesus statue in an affluent area? The result will shock you.
The wealthy respond with compassion.
We also have a wonderful Tea Partier's response to, but he shares with us what the Bundy Ranch strategy was if there was a showdown. And the strategy is quite shocking. In fact, it's really shocking and really
Gandhi-esque.
Weird. Yes.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
That and much more.
Much, much more. So we're going to take a brief break. We'll be back with Eli Clifton in just a moment. Thanks for listening.
We'll be right back. I finished probation, boy. Not head with no chaser, boy. From the mouth, I can spit out a razor, boy. Open up your face and like your boy in his prime. Eat food, dinner time, junior gong, pass the Guinness. Handle business, black velvet, sippers, females never bid us farewell. They with us, cause we arrive on a scene just like a high beam, nah, I mean. Those of us have to make the nine scream, nah, I mean. At your racial police, ain't regime, nah, I mean. Spiritual well like an Elohim, nah, I mean. In a casino or a
out wherever I'm seen. My brothers and sisters are never forgotten, I mean. Don't wanna hear another soldier drop, nah, I mean. Another dope addict is shot with the morphine. And feds are indicting my block, nah, I mean. They're wearing reds from their shoes to their top, nah, I mean. I'm wishing that all the violence would stop, nah, I mean.
When I like this song, I'm sorry, nah, I mean. And some boys stop like ice cream, nah, I mean. From a boy, make the feds intervene, nah, I mean. Wishing I were gonna take him choppy, nah, I mean. Parabellum, them are each up in a spleen, nah, I mean. In a Queen's gunman reign supreme, nah, I mean. Kingstonians are real blood fiends, nah, I mean. The world is a big crime scene, nah, I mean.
Yo, yo, Mr. President.
Yo, Mr. President.
What you doing for my residence?
What you doing with my residence?
Yo, Mr. Minister.
Mr. Minister.
Why you being sinister? Hey.
Yo, yo, Mr. President.
Yo, yo, Mr. President.
What you doing for my residence?
What you doing with my residence?
Yo, Mr. Minister.
Mr. Minister.
Why you being sinister?
Someone in a real buffalo in a Rastafari regime. Bush bungalow where me dwell with my queen. Trash put the bundung in a camouflage green. Love for them where can't go the places we've been. Love for them where can't see the sights where we've seen. That's why them face all a twist up on a lean, I mean. They better mind we kick it off clean, I mean. Man a gangster just like Yamdeen. That mean them can't serve Congo jet quotes up in, I mean. And who you want come in convene, I mean. Attorney of Iraq and come in, I mean. Me pocket them green like Sperlin, I mean. Me regular fly out and fly in, I mean. The stadium park like sardine, I mean. Can't get no speed up as the whole need caffeine. Run out of retin antihistamine. Wash over golem come in like Listerine. You think I lie way better than Al Pacino, I mean.
It's genocide, it's a genocide. It's a genocide, it's a genocide. Fifth floor cooking raw, had my own supply. Cause of capitalist ways, that was back in the days. So now I do rap and it pays.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Eli Clifton. He is a investigative Matt, help me.
Eli Clifton,
that's unbelievable.
He is a investigative reporter. He's a fellow reporting fellow.
This is a total disaster. Eli Clifton's a guy I met in front of Penn Station. He has some interesting ideas.
No, he's a reporting fellow at the Investigative Fund for the Nation Institute.
Is that correct?
Ding, 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 ding.
Okay. All right. I don't know what it is. Yes, but where he does very good work, which we'll be talking about more confidently than I introduced him. Eli, how are you?
I'm actually the crazy homeless guy who screams at you every day.
Yeah.
Doing well yourself?
I'm doing well. Yeah, I saw Eli on 33rd and 6th, and he was just saying, I want to be on the show. And I said, okay, all right.
Why'd you use your Bob Beckel impression for that?
That's how Bob Beckel got his job at Fox. Okay. They said, we would love for you to represent the Democratic point of view, Bob. That sounds great. Okay. All right. So before this completely goes off the rails, let's get to – you have a couple of recent pieces out that are both very important and actually speak to probably the defining domestic issue that we're dealing with right now and an essential foreign policy issue as well. And they both deal with the funding process of politics, which is a significant part of how politics actually gets done. So we're going to start first with this piece that appeared in Salon. It's called "The Exclusive Shady Double Agents Obamacare Sabotage: Top Supporter Quietly Funded Its Opposition." Now, I think a lot of people in this audience are familiar with the Obama administration's decision to try to appease the pharma industry in a run-up to passing Obamacare. And obviously there's a lot of debate about that. I don't think there's much substantive debate. The policy implications were not good. But at any rate, but there's an established narrative that pharma kind of laid down its arms. And your report shows that it actually didn't. It played a double game. So explain that double game and who this shady double agent is.
Well, I think, as you just said, you know, a big part of the narrative around the passage of the Affordable Care Act was that pivotal point, I believe it was in 2010, when the White House, as well as members of mainly the Democratic Party on the Hill, negotiated with the pharmaceutical lobby, which is known as PHRMA, P-H-R-M-A, which is their lobbying arm in Washington, about specifically drug prices. That was the thing that really stuck for the pharmaceutical industry. Understandably, that is their product. And they were concerned that the Affordable Care Act would gut their profits, and according to them, the result would be an inability to invest in research and development of new drugs. Now, the way that panned out is that pharma ended up getting drug pricing concessions, or essentially they were guaranteed profits going forward for at least, I believe, 10 years of a certain amount, which is sort of unheard of in a free market system to be promised a certain degree of profit. And in exchange, they publicly went on the record of saying that they supported the Affordable Care Act. They applauded it when it was passed. And it looked as if that there had been, compromises made on both sides. Both sides certainly claimed that they had been taken advantage of. Folks on the right said that the pharmaceutical industry had sold out. And folks on the left said that the White House had sold out, as well as congressional leadership, by being willing to go to the table with the pharmaceutical industry on these issues and sell out on drug pricing concessions. Now, I think what I've tried to show in this article is that the truth is that while they were negotiating this, pharma was also investing in state-level legislation that would block aspects of implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And they did so pretty much exactly in the time period in which they were starting to publicly be identified as negotiating with the White House.
Yeah. So who specifically was this leading pharma lobbyist who you have basically, you also spoke with him for the article, and you mm-hmm. have him actually publicly bragging about pharma support for the passage of the Affordable Care Act after it passed, as well as his, being a prime player in funding these state initiatives through ALEC, which is another name that is important here, which is obviously very familiar to a lot of our audience as well.
Well, I mean, the key player here is a guy named Billy Tauzin. He's a former congressman from Louisiana, and he went on to become the head of pharma. And the thing about Tauzin and talking with him on the phone, as well as his reputation in Washington, and you can even see it in the article here in terms of his own statements, is that he's extremely smooth. This guy was one of the top paid lobbyists in Washington when he retired. Pharma handed him $11.6 million, and based off of every conversation, the one conversation I've had with him, as well as his reputation, he deserved every penny of it. This guy is like a top tier lobbyist. You can throw anything at him, any type of hardball question, and nothing fazes him.
Right.
In the conversations I had with him, I assumed that he would get heated or something about the suggestion I was making that he had engaged in sort of a two-faced negotiating strategy with the White House. And it was exactly the opposite. I mean, he embraced the fact that he had certainly been involved with supporting ALEC and supporting their agenda. That's the American Legislative Exchange Council, which promotes a vast variety of state-level legislation, generally anti-regulatory. And low taxes, of course, go with that. And between 2008 and 2011, pharma handed them $1.25 million. And Tauzin's take on it is, yeah, sure, we gave them money. We support a free market. We support conservative economic policy. And that's, that all falls in line with our industry as well as ALEC. Tauzin embraces it.
Right. I mean, he's the type of guy that I'm the only reason if you watch True Detective, people will know this analogy, but there's this kind of, in True Detective, one of the plot segments is the possibility of very powerful politicians being involved in just these, absolutely horrific and hideous crimes. And Tauzin is the type of guy that if you asked him and said, hey, are you, in any way involved in a, potentially like, a sex trafficking ring, he'd be like, oh, well, maybe I was, and we made sure all those girls got educations or something. He nothing would faze him. I mean, the kind of brazenness level is astonishing, is just astonishing. And I mean, but I guess to get specifically with what were the specific pieces of state legislation that ALEC was backing? Also, just to be clear, I think you said that pharma undertook that contribution, the money they gave ALEC was second only, I think, to was it Philip Morris, someone in the tobacco industry?
Reynolds.
Of Reynolds, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it was second to Reynolds, which is kind of interesting that Alex seems to be largely supported by the cigarette industry and the pharmaceutical industry, which, although people may have negative views about both of those industries, one would, at least in my mind, rarely think of them as working in concert.
Right.
But in this case, they appear to, or at least Alec was able to embrace policies that appeased both of those divergent interest groups. But Alec started something called their Healthcare Freedom Initiative. And the Healthcare Freedom Initiative provided a guide to state legislatures about how they could limit their state's participation in Obamacare, in the Affordable Care Act. Now, a number of aspects of this are now moot because of the Supreme Court decision, but there still are individual pieces here and there that this legislation is it continues to pass. A version of it just passed the Georgia State Senate and is now been sent to the governor to sign, that continue to get traction. And these laws tend to be called the Healthcare Freedom Act or the Freedom in Healthcare Acts. There's over 17 of them now have passed state legislatures around the country, and I think we'll continue to see them popping up. Alec clearly has this as a priority. Now, Tazen claims, when I put this to him, that, well, it seems like there's kind of double dealing going on here. Of course, he has a great out. So, well, Alec took specific positions on his own. The reason we allied was around that great central theme of protecting free market health care. The reason we supported Alec, and I'd support them today for that reason, is that they represent a conservative economic view. So Tazen is very good at being able to back away from the challenge of addressing individual aspects of Alec's behavior and agenda when it's a political necessity for him to back away.
Yeah, so the other important question that this raises is, and you know, this does go to the kind of larger question, obviously, of the decision that the decisions Obama administration pursued in getting this deal, and I think as you know the ACA kind of turns into reality, we see which you know I think people like I'm assuming you and certainly me I think are being relatively vindicated on the whole and kind of. That this was a real improvement over the status quo, which was a really dysfunctional and unacceptable status quo. And it's probably as about, you know, of all of the options on the table, this was maybe the most realistically doable, but it was also the kind of smallest substantive improvement possible. And I think that, you know, because obviously there have been problems in implementation and, you know, there is a clunkiness in this law. But, you know, you definitely seem to report, and there's no reason to doubt that the Obama administration, you know, pursued their negotiations with pharma in good faith and were kind of blindsided by this. And I guess, you know, what does that kind of tell us about their approach to this deal? Because it seems like on one hand, there's this real, well, we have to be so pragmatic and so kind of politically attentive that we'll – you know, cut this deal with pharma, which is, as you say, guaranteeing future profits. I mean, you know, this is not defensible policy. This is just pure deal making. And, you know, maybe it's justified, maybe it's not. But on the other hand, you know, with that pragmatism didn't prepare them for, you know, all of this money flowing to Alec, which incidentally, you would think might not be something if it goes on from 2008 through 2011 that the administration would be, you know, entirely unaware of.
Right. I mean, and I think that the point you make at the end about it's a little hard to believe that they were completely unaware of it is probably spot on. There certainly is a possibility that they have been completely blindsided by this and never saw that the pharmaceutical industry might be hedging their bets in negotiating with the White House. I think the truth of the matter is the White House probably, whether they knew explicitly about these activities or not, understood that pharma was playing a very careful game and one in which they were certainly not willing to throw wholehearted support behind the Affordable Care Act, and they were looking to create every loophole they could in it before its passage. Pharma, for their part, probably read the tea leaves and saw that this legislation was popular and was going to pass, and as a result, sought to get whatever concessions they could from the White House in the process. So, I mean, I don't think any of the actors here were totally naive. I think some of the folks in Congress, some of the negotiators in various congressional offices may have been a little more naive about what was going on. I've actually spoken to some of them, and they claim to have never heard of any of these activities on Alec's part. But I think the reality is that at least my hunch is that everybody involved went into it eyes open. Everybody was trying to get the best deal they could. The White House definitely wanted to get pharma on board. At the very least, they didn't want to have pharma as an enemy when they were actually trying to pass the legislation. And to that, in that sense, they were successful in bringing pharma on board, at least temporarily in a very public sense. But yeah, this is how the sausage and the laws get made. And it's not pretty. And people hedge their bets, and they do so in ways that would seem to be sort of contradictory.
Right. Well, it's pretty for Billy Tozen at any rate. But this is shifting gears a bit. You have another piece, recent piece, which appeared in The Nation, I believe, where you talked about a guy named Paul Singer, who is a very successful hedge fund guy in New York, who's known as a big Republican donor, and is sort of getting somewhat of a reputation as, you know, being one of these kind of big money guys who wants to moderate the GOP. And essentially that's because I think he has a son who is a gay man. He's very supportive of marriage equality. Now, one part of the, you know, other part of him, obviously, is that he's a unrepentant and, you know, ultra right wing when it comes to economic policies and kind of guarding his economic interests through campaign contributions. But you've also raised the fact that he also, you know, more quietly perhaps, but similar to other mega donors like a Sheldon Adelson, as an example, has an incredibly far right view of the Middle East and is actually agitating for really hawkish policies towards Iran. So kind of, you know, explain that for us.
Right. Well, Paul Singer, he's the head of Elliott Management. That's the name of his hedge fund. Has, according to a number of documents I've looked at, been one of the largest, if not the largest donor in certain instances, to various groups that have been pushing for very hawkish policies with Iran. First and foremost is probably the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Documents that I'd published in a previous article show that between 2008 and 2011, he was their second largest donor after Home Depot founder Bernard Marcus. And FDD, who also receives money from Sheldon Adelson, who advocated a preemptive nuclear attack on Iran.
That would harm no one, to be fair.
Yeah. Right, in the middle of the desert.
Yeah,
so
yeah. Maybe a animal. And it was funny because I think he actually said maybe a rattlesnake would die or something. But that was
right.
Also inaccurate because, of course, there aren't rattlesnakes there. But at any rate.
It may have been projection because he was thinking Nevada. But
Sheldon Adelson wants to nuke Nevada. That's – wow. Eli, you're reporting a new – I'm sorry. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I mean, hey, you know, yeah, I've been to Nevada. It's okay. But FDD is really, really, really out there. That they've been consistently advocating preventive strikes against Iran's nuclear facilities, right in the middle, right as you know the first touch and go negotiations were going during in October 2013 between Iran and the P5+1, the United States. We have FDD director Mark Dubowitz and their fellow rail Mark Gorecht writing in the Washington Post that what we need right now is more sanctions.
Right.
And we also have them, and we also have Singer supporting outfits like the American Enterprise Institute, which is promoted far more so probably than any other organization, the invasion of Iraq, and the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, which in March of last year made the case that taking military action off the table against Iran undermines all other options short of war, which is at least a distinction I can't really understand. So, but I think kind of the point I was really trying to get at with this article is that, you know, all the attention on Paul Singer, and for that matter, there's another hedge funder who he's worked very closely with, Dan Loeb, is focusing on the fact that they want to be known as the Wall Street-friendly, socially progressive face of the Republican Party.
Right.
They are the version of the Republican Party that fiscal conservatives in Manhattan can get behind. But what's not being reported is that while they might have a fairly progressive social agenda and a traditional fiscally conservative economic policies, their foreign policy agenda is way out there. And that's something that's being overlooked.
Yeah, actually, and that's a really crucial point. And before we wrap up, I mean, I think one of the things that I really appreciate among many, obviously, about your reporting, specifically with regards to people like Paul Singer, is to what extent to which, even after all of these, if we're going to, you know, we could use the shorthand of neoconservative foreign policy or whatever, after so many just blunders and failures and really just kind of robustly catastrophic decision-making and advocacy in foreign policy that has been endlessly contradicted in just, you know, empirically and, you know, analytically, it seems like this still isn't reported or thought of as being quite that extreme. So even if you were to read a piece about Singer that was just kind of summarizing him, you know, doing just trying to do a kind of neutral job, you would say like, okay, he's, you know, he's again socially progressive, very pro Wall Street, a Wall Street man, and he's, you know, he takes a tough line in the Middle East or something. You know, one of these kind of generic sort of taglines that don't really mean much and actually conceal what you're saying, which is really radical extremist views in the Middle East, even after you know, all of the blunders that those ideas have already taken us through.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple things in play here. One is that Americans, for the most part, foreign policy is not a top line issue for most people. So it's easier to get away with having a radical foreign policy agenda if you have more moderate or at least mainstream economic or social views. And certainly people like Singer fall within that sphere. You know, his economic agenda is very pro Wall Street. It's very anti-regulatory. While a lot of people would disagree with that, it's not too far outside of the mainstream. Whereas, the point is that, if you, advocate for war, historically, certainly the past, 12 years have shown us, you can get away with it with very little, consequence. And that's, to the second point is the media's fault, because in profiling somebody like Singer, and the reason I wrote this piece is that there was recently a Washington Post profile of him, and this lengthy profile, buried two-thirds of the way down, was like three sentences about his foreign policy views, which they characterized as staunchly pro-Israel, right, being on the board of the Republican Jewish Coalition, and a member of a large American delegation that went to celebrate Israel's 60th anniversary in 2008. Well, I mean, how much more can you distill, or not even distill, but practically mislead your readers about this person's views and the positions that they're advocating for in terms of U.S. foreign policy? Yeah, sure, there's an Israel tie-in, but the truth is that this guy supports organizations that historically have pushed for war, that have pushed for unnecessary wars in the case of the invasion of Iraq. And have gone on to hire the people out of the George W. Bush administration who played a central role in executing that war.
Right. So they could just say, and parenthetically, he advocates for policy that could lead to a, you know, complete global meltdown emanating out of the Middle East. And he also took a trip to Jerusalem. Okay, back to marriage equality. Eli Clifton, both of these pieces, the one on Paul Singer is in The Nation, and the piece on the Pharma deal is in Salon. Eli Clifton, wait for it, is a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. Thank you so
much
for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Eli. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
All right, folks, we're going to take a brief break. I see in my corner of my eye, Binder preparing. All right, we're going to take a brief break, and Matt is going to speak with what's the guy's name again?
Matt Ford
of the Atlantic.
Yep.
About the Bundy Ranch. And then we're flying to Nevada together to get those tax dollars. No, I'm just kidding. All right, we'll be right back, folks. We'll be right back.
Wow, Michael, that was very smooth transition out of that music.
Not responding to that.
All right, we are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder, and I am joined today by my co-host, Michael Brooks. And well, go ahead. And joining us now, he is a fellow at The Atlantic, and also he is from Nevada. Matt Ford, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. Just had to make sure I got that Nevada right. It's Nevada. Jeez.
Oh yeah, it's Nevada. I notice out here in the East, people pronounce it a lot differently, but I'm willing to overlook it.
Thank you for that. Otherwise, I would know what I would do. So I wanted to have you on the show today because you wrote this piece for The Atlantic about the irony of Cliven Bundy's unconstitutional stand. And we had a guest on yesterday to basically update our listeners on what was going on with this whole Bundy Ranch saga, because it seemed like everyone was talking about it, but all the reports were from clearly biased right-wing news outlets. And so basically we gave our listeners a rundown, yet there still seems to be this discrepancy, even with people in the leftist communities, about what Cliven Bundy's stance is here. Because does he have a leg to stand on in terms of his claims to using the land if you're someone who, for example, like libertarians, hold states' rights above all else? And you wrote this piece that basically tackles this head on. And I personally think this is the argument that really, really dissolves all the right-wing, libertarianism, federalist arguments to Bundy Ranch, Cliven Bundy's claims for Bundy Ranch. So let's get right to it in terms of what is Cliven Bundy arguing in terms of why he thinks Bundy Ranch is in the right in using this land for grazing his cattle.
Well, I think that you summed it up pretty well. His argument is based on a sort of states' rights doctrine that Nevada does not fall within the purview of federal law, in his view. He does not hold himself as a subject to federal law, despite contesting the BLM's actions in court since 1993. His view is that the BLM is engaged in sort of an unauthorized taking of his cattle. The BLM, of course, says that this is because he is in arrears over well over $1 million in fines that he owes for letting his cattle graze on federal land, which makes up about 85% of the land in Nevada. This kind of juxtaposition between endorsing a very states' rights view, saying that he is defending Nevada law, versus an overreaching, perhaps tyrannical federal government, attracted many people to his cause. And what I wanted to point out in my article was that this doesn't jive with the Nevada Constitution itself, which says that federal law is absolutely supreme.
So let's, before we get to what is in the Nevada Constitution that gives this, that basically gives pretty much ends Clive and Bundy's argument. Let's talk about, you go into the history of what led to this being written into Nevada's Constitution this way. I think it's important to bring this up because Clive and Bundy's main argument is, main claim to this land is that his family's rights go back to the 1860s with this land. Could you go into Nevada's history in terms of what led to the Constitution being written in such a way?
Well, absolutely. Nevada holds kind of in the order of states that apply to the Union, Nevada holds kind of an almost unique position. Prior to the Civil War in 1860, most of the states had joined in tandem to preserve the balance between free states and slave states. So, for example, Maine joins along with some of the slave states that required a Mexican secession, so on and so forth. West Virginia was one of two states that also joined during the Union, and Nevada was the second that joined during the Civil War. West Virginia is kind of a unique example. I won't get into it, but Nevada was one of the few territories that was set up aside at the same time. Now, Nevada at this time was heavily mining-oriented. The population was very low, some say below what Congress had set for the minimum requirements to be a state. But in about 1863, 1864, the population was very eager to become a state. They thought that it would protect them from local judicial overreach. They thought it would help them more effectively tax mining companies. And so they heavily pushed for statehood. At the same time, they were fortunate because Abraham Lincoln was preparing for his reelection campaign. And Abraham Lincoln thought that it would be a much tougher uphill battle than it actually turned out to be. So he and the Republican Congress helped push through Nevada's statutes, the Nevada Organic Act. And as part of that, it required that Nevada turn over all unappropriated public land to the federal government, which they readily did. Now, the clause that I discuss was part of the very pro-union sentiment in the state at the time. They also took the initiative to add a clause to their constitution that said that they swore sort of a very deep oath of fealty to the federal government at a time when the federal government was engaged in a life or death struggle with the Confederacy. The paramount allegiance of every citizen, the Constitution says, is due to the federal government and the exercise of all its constitutional powers. Later on, it goes on to say that if any portion of the states or its people resist federal authority, the federal government may warrant the use of armed force to sort of quell the uprising.
Interesting.
Now, there are some oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I just said interesting.
Yeah.
Especially with what happened this past weekend, yes.
Yeah, there's sort of a kind of direct connection there. Now, this is the principle of federal legal supremacy isn't unusual. We see it every day. And similar kind of paramount allegiance clauses exist in some of the southern state constitutions. They added them in after Reconstruction when they rejoined the Union. Mm-hmm. Now, none of them go on at length about authorizing federal armed engagement because Nevada's is kind of unique, the passions of the time, so to speak.
So I want to make sure the timeline here is perfectly understood. What year is this written into Nevada's constitution?
Exactly. And the timeline really matters here because of what Clive and Bundy is claiming. Now, Nevada was taken in the treaty that ended the Mexican-American War from Mexico. So that's in about the 1840s. In 1860, Nevada becomes a territory. And in 1864, Nevada becomes a state. Cliven Bundy claims, and I've seen alternative between 1870 and 1880, as to when his ancestors settled this land. Mm-hmm. So he comes in between 10 and maybe 20 years after Nevada became a state, after Nevada forfeited its public lands to the federal government, and after Nevada promised to uphold federal law at all costs.
So this is clearly all before his claim that his ancestors were there.
Oh, absolutely.
I just want to make that crystal clear for everybody listening. So this basically makes all of his claims that this is Nevada's land, the state of Nevada's land, and he should be paying the state. This all makes that moot.
Yeah. I would say that the situation would be different if there was kind of a competing claim of public land. You know, Nevada and some of the western states are much different than states out in the east, and that large swaths of them are owned by the federal government. So if he was in a place like, you know, New York or Texas, where the percentage is much different, we would be dealing with a different circumstance here. But there's absolutely no chance that this land is owned by the state government. Even the federal court that has ordered him to turn over the cattle admits as much.
So this is an issue where this guy Cliven Bundy is basically refusing to you even say in your piece that you quote him as saying that he doesn't even recognize the United States government as even existing. He said that?
Yeah. He told a radio interview last week, something to the effect of that he believes in a sovereign state of Nevada. And he believes that he doesn't recognize the federal government as, quote, even existing, which one can readily disprove by observation.
Yeah.
But it's a very kind of absolutist stance, that doesn't really give him much wiggle room in terms of negotiation or de-escalation. It would be quite a thing for him to say that on one day the federal government simply does not exist, and on the second day the federal government with all its, you know, officers and marshals and judges springs forth into existence.
Now he did try to pay these fees, because I want to be fair here and make sure I get this all correct here. He did try to pay these fees to the state. He just refuses to pay them to the federal government. I believe the state sent him back the money or refused to take the money when he sent it to them?
I believe that's correct, yes. He tried to pay them to Clark County, but since Clark County doesn't own the land, they did not really have any claim to the money that he owed. That money instead rightfully belongs to the Bureau of Land Management. It's about a $200 per head fine back in 1993 per head of cattle. And, you know, for these grazing rights that tens of thousands of ranchers across the United States pay every day, as the BLM pointed out, he simply does not believe he has to pay them because, according to him, Nevada is a sovereign state and the federal government's authority is not recognized.
So I think this really, especially with what happened this weekend and what you laid in your piece, these right-wing groups are really taking Cliven Bundy as this federalist, libertarian, mm-hmm. pro-states' rights hero. Do you have a sense of how this is activated these states' rights groups? I mean, they're clearly completely either unaware of or purposefully not acknowledging what the state of Nevada has written in its constitution, which is what they claim to want to uphold.
Absolutely. It's kind of a startling turn of events for them that they would on one hand say that, you know, Nevada's laws are supreme over this federal violation of their rights, so they say. And then on the other hand, the Nevada constitution completely disagrees. The influx of out-of-state militias and state sovereignists has been actually quite remarkable. I don't know if you've seen any of the photos in which these men are all heavily armed.
Yes.
And many of them evoke kind of comparisons, both themselves and dealing with others, to Waco or Ruby Ridge or any of the string of, you know, federal versus militia showdowns that we saw in the 1990s, many of which ended in bloodshed.
So you're a Nevadan, correct?
Yes.
I think we clarified that in the beginning. So do you have a sense of what? Because another argument I see here is that the BLM has driven off all these ranchers off this federal land, and Cliven Bundy is the last man standing, and he's the last stand between the tyrannical federal government and freedom, and their argument is that the majority of ranchers, not just ranchers, Nevadans, Westerners, are standing behind Cliven Bundy. Do you have a sense of what the majority of people, or even people who are in the area, ranchers, even what they feel about this issue? I mean, I'm assuming that people who aren't in this county, there still are ranchers, I'm sure, in the West, and I'm sure they all pay their fees, even if Cliven Bundy is the last one in Clark County or whatever county he's in. Do you have a sense of what people who are directly affected directly affected by this whole Bundy Ranch saga, how they feel about this?
One of the interesting things I think you touched upon that's worth highlighting is that there are other ranchers out there. And while Cliven Bundy may be kind of an isolated example, it's undeniable that they've all faced economic pressures over the past few years. And he cites federal regulation. But as you know, Nevada is also in the midst of a pretty severe drought, along with California and some of the neighboring western states. There's increased competition from markets overseas, which can supposedly more cheaply raise beef. So there is kind of a sense that this is a dwindling lifestyle out west. Children aren't necessarily picking it up like their fathers did. There's a serious fear that the continuity may be broken. Now, that doesn't mean that it's all going to disappear tomorrow. There are still, you know, thousands of ranchers in northern Nevada. There are still plenty out in, you know, states like Wyoming, Montana, elsewhere throughout the West and Midwest. But Cliven Bundy's claims that he is some sort of symbol for this does play upon a very, you know, serious fear that this lifestyle is disappearing. The tragedy is that the way he's portraying it is a little detached from kind of legal and situational reality. Many of the problems that he's facing are not necessarily the same problems that are affecting the lifestyles of ranchers elsewhere in the state or even elsewhere in the country.
It's really interesting to me that I'm really glad you wrote this piece, because everywhere I've been looking about just to try to, you know, educate myself about the Bundy Ranch situation, and I'm sure many people have been trying to as well, as it was pretty much the talk of the weekend, and it's still being talked about going into this week. It's just that so many people are distorting the different claims to the land. And before we end this wrap this interview up, I just want to make sure that we have this crystal clear here, that the Cliven Bundy does not own this land, so it's not private property, because obviously if it was his land, he would have some sort of deed or proof of ownership to this property. He'd been paying some sort of land taxes, etc.
Yeah.
And then
I'm sorry, continue.
No, please continue.
Well, I think that's one of the key things, is that what the situation is that we often think that the ranches are kind of these family-owned things, and in many cases, many parts of them are. But cattle graze over a wide area, and his cattle grazed on land that was owned mostly by the federal government, as is the case in all of Nevada, as I've mentioned. Mm-hmm. That kind of changes the dynamic, because he's no longer, you know, using his own land and then the federal government is coming to take his cattle away. That would be a very different situation. What he's doing is using his cattle on public land that belongs to all Nevadans, all Americans, really, and using that to graze his cattle, and then not paying the fees that are associated with that. Now, he may contort arguments of state sovereignty and the Tenth Amendment and things like that, but it doesn't change the underlying dynamic that, you know, thousands of other ranchers pay these, you know, their cattle grazing costs. If they go over, they pay the fines. his sort of exceptionalism to this is really kind of jarring in the larger context.
It's interesting you bring that up about the ownership of the land, because it made me think, you know, with the types of the ideologies that play into these groups that are supporting him, what would be the reaction if, say, you know, this was private land not owned by Cliven Bundy, and Cliven Bundy was renting this land from this private landowner, and he decided to stop paying these fees? It makes me think what their reaction would be. I highly doubt armed militia groups would be showing up trying to stop this landowner from pushing Cliven Bundy off his land when Cliven Bundy isn't paying the fees.
I think you're absolutely right. When you hear some of the quotes and some of the interviews that people have done with these with the supporters of Cliven Bundy who've showed up, many of their grievances are not pertaining to necessarily federal public land use rights, which is still a contentious topic. There's definitely a policy debate to have there. Many of their arguments go to a broader sort of oppositional stance towards federal power in all spheres, whether it's immigration, whether it is simple the other perceptions of rights that they say have been lost under the current federal government, under the Obama administration, and really the changing of a lifestyle out there that they perceive to be responsible by the federal government.
Matt Ford, fellow at The Atlantic. The piece is The Irony of Cliven Bundy's Unconstitutional Stand. Listeners, if you come across any right-wing relative, some libertarian you follow on Facebook, and they argue about the semantics of this all and who owns this land and whether Cliven Bundy actually has a claim to it, be sure to send them a link to Matt Ford's piece in The Atlantic. Matt Ford, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It was an absolute pleasure.
Take care.
Bye.
All right, folks. That is our free half of the show today. We will be going to the better half. Well, before we go into the better half, we totally forgot to mention this. Today marks the one-year anniversary, I guess you could call it, of the tragedy that was the Boston Marathon bombing.
Yeah.
Call it a
hundreds, probably burst, thousands of lives forever changed due to that. Three people were killed in that bombing.
Many lost limbs. And then, of course,
I believe there were lives lost later in the
security guard
who were trying to catch the brothers who perpetrated this.
The only thing I'd add to it is, I grew up in the western part of the state of Massachusetts, but I did spend some time living in Boston. My sister went to college in Boston. I remember the day it happened, she was actually in California, but she was really – we both couldn't talk to our friends in the city because all the phone lines were shut down. And there really was a chunk of time where nobody had any idea what was happening. And, it's a great event. It's really horrible. And the thing I think we do need to get into the habit of really emphasizing, one of the brothers is dead. The other one's going to go to, prison. I oppose the death penalty. I don't want, I'm not a supporter of the death penalty, but he'll get life in prison or he'll get a death sentence. I'm interested in some people did amazing acts of heroism on that
yes,
day.
Yes, yes.
People, there was enormous, risk-taking, and one of the most depressing things was there was a little boy who got murdered.
Oh, there's a great multi-piece story in the Boston Globe where they follow his family in the time after, and it's – you should go read it.
We'll put a link to the site, but there was a photo that people showed of the boy holding a sign in a class, before the attacks, obviously. And I don't remember. I won't make it up. I don't remember the exact wording of it, but I remember it was something like
it was a message of peace.
It was a message of peace, and it was clearly very heartfelt. And it's really actually time to listen to that.
When
it's time to acknowledge the really great acts of that day as well. And great,
when there's events like that, let's not harp on the revenge or the let's justice must be served. We should really, the stories that come out of that should be, the perseverance, the helping one another, you know,
people saving each
find
other's
the
lives.
Positive
people literally find, saving each other's
find
lives.
The positive and the negative.
And yeah, and you know, it's and also just even in the glorification, like this guy who did this thing yesterday, I mean, look, everybody's going to read articles about him, and you know,
you're talking about the white power who shot up the Jewish centers,
who murdered, and you know, and I know David Pakman did an interview with him, and all, and I get it, and I'm looking at that stuff and I'm reading stuff, but for me personally, you know, without like I didn't do an interview with him or anything, so there isn't anything substantive for me to talk about. I don't even want to mention his name. Yeah. I want to honor the people that lost their lives. I want to honor the community, the Jewish community, and the broader community that was affected in Kansas. And that's it. I don't even want to utter the guy's name.
And
I don't want
also,
any infamy
it's
for
also,
him.
It's also important to look at the politics of it all because that plays
Absolutely.
A role in it happening, period.
Absolutely. So we will move on. And it was very fitting that we did this all before we transitioned to the fun half.
Because we
this
couldn't
is
do
just
that.
Absolutely devastating.
This is completely not even...
It's not even Sam Cedar.
Yeah, not even Sam Cedar fun half.
It's genuinely really painful human tragedy.
From the fun half, the latest CBO report, and we'll be talking about upholding the latest Social Security.
Look at you, Sam. I didn't realize you. We're stepping now from not only does Sam not do the fun show, now we're just like, and Mark Begich is an increase in Social Security. And that's just, I could not be more excited, Shannon. Anyways.
All right, let's go to the better half.
Okay, but before we go to the better half.
Majority.fm, become a member. You click that, become a member. Oh, and we should also run down the week for freebies and so they're not lost. There's not going to be any YouTube live streams this week, obviously, because they'll all be pre-taped shows or best ofs. So we'll be back live. That includes the YouTube live stream on next Tuesday. I don't know the date of that. What is that? The 22nd? No, 23rd. No, we're off Tuesday.
No, we'll be back Wednesday.
We'll be back Wednesday, the 23rd. Tuesday's our last day off. And then tomorrow, there will be a Matt and Mike show. It'll be pre-taped. We'll do a little bit different than we usually do, a little bit more laid back, you know, going into the...
It's
going
to be all fun half.
Yes, as we're well into the Passover week and upcoming the Christian holidays, if any of you celebrate any of that, happy holidays. And then on Thursday, Friday, Monday, Tuesday, we will have best ofs, archive shows. There are stuff you have never heard. Because we are talking deep, deep, deep archives. Air America archives. We're talking about 10 years ago archives.
Okay, so we have a great week for you. Become a member today.
Subscribe to the show at youtube.com/Sam Cedar. That's subscribe to the YouTube channel. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/Majority Report. Follow us on Twitter at MajorityFM. MajorityApp.com. You should be getting all of your friends to download the app. Boom, that's simple. And then to support this show, if you can't afford to become a member, and even if you can, you can give us extra money by going to MajorityReportKickback.com and buying all your Amazon junk through there.
Oh, and also let's not forget the great Fair Trade Coffee.
Fair Trade Coffee. Ugh. JustCoffee.coop. Use coupon code Majority. You save money and they know where that customer came from.
And I just have to say, I mean, we all know, you know, the very mixed bag about Amazon. But if you're looking for a company that they do great work, everybody who benefits being in business with them, including us in our own small way, that's the place to get your coffee. No doubt about it. We will see you in the fun half.
We will. Take care.